Good morning, friends. Welcome. Nice to see you. Hey, Lou, how are you?
Good morning. How are we doing today?
Good, good. Early morning start today.
Early morning start today, but that's good.
It's good. It's good.
Nice way to start, yes.
Did you have your coffee?
I have my tea. Yes, I am ready to go.
Yeah, you're a tea drinker like I am.
Yes.
Good, good. So, friends, we've been talking about chapter 18, verses 45, 46 we did last time. If you are joining us without looking at the last episode, today's 207, so the last one would be 206, episode 206. Maybe it's a good idea for you to go back to look at that one first, listen to that one first before you get to this, because it's sort of like a continuation. So this verse, verse 47, essentially says that it is better to do your own swadharma. Swadharma is your own duty, your own personal duty that you're born with, rather than doing somebody else's, even if the duty that you're doing for somebody else's comes out better and is more rewarding and you get more popularity and fame, whereas your own duty does not produce as much merit. And that if you do your own swadharma, you do not incur any sin, is what it says. So what does all this mean? The first thing you have to realize is that we are all born with certain qualities, certain personality traits, certain vasanas, certain raga and dvesha, likes and dislikes, wishes, desires, all of from our previous experiences in previous lives. We've talked about this before, but when a person dies and his mind and intellect and his prana, everything goes into the next body, it carries with it impressions from the previous life that it has made, things that it has learned to dislike or like greatly. It carries over, its skills carries over to the new life. So you've seen that with child prodigies who for a very young age are able to do phenomenal things. And from a very early age, tell you, you know, that they want to do those things, whether it be music or mathematics or dance or the scriptures, you know, the ability to understand scriptures and to talk about them and to understand them, whereas others have different likes and dislikes. These all come from previous experiences. So that is then your swadharma, your own duty that you're born with. Your duty is to follow whatever your inborn instincts, your personality traits are, your strengths are. So these are your accumulated gunas, the gunas, the nature that you have accumulated from past lives, and which is known as your prakriti, your personality, your vasanas, your inherent tendencies, your raga, your likes, your dvesha, your dislikes. And so that produces your distinct personality, and you see that very commonly in children when they're very young. It's most marked as a child prodigy, but you also see it in, I've seen it in my own grandchildren, that one is distinctly different from the other, although born of the same parents, even twins. Mm. So when you follow your swadharma, you're calm, you're peaceful, there's no agitation and no sin. Now, we've said this before, but I'll say it again. Sin in any context, in any of these Gita verses or the Upanishads, sin refers to mental agitation that is produced as a result of an action or a thought. So that's sin. We think about it differently, but that's really what the meaning is. So why is mental agitation so disliked in the scriptures? Why is mental peace so liked in the scriptures? Because the whole purpose of this is to try to reach the self, to try to reach the self within you. And you can do that only through meditation. So to meditate, you've got to get rid of anything that disturbs you, anything that disturbs your mental peace that you can get to the self. So if you're sitting down and you have mental agitation, you're not going to be able to meditate. If you're sitting down and your mind is completely at peace, you are going to meditate and be able to reach the self. So All of these things, getting rid of your vasanas, getting rid of your mental agitation, getting rid of your negativities, your desires, all of that is all one purpose. And that is so that when you meditate, you can do it without distraction. So he's saying there's no sin when you do what you like to do, although you may not do it well. What does that mean? I gave this example in the previous episode. I'll say it briefly, that when I was growing up, my mother, for a number of reasons, wanted me to be a physician. I didn't like blood. I didn't like pain. I didn't like inflicting pain on others when I'm trying to stick them with needles to draw blood. I couldn't bring myself to dissect a body or to cut and open an animal to do the dissections. It was against my grain. Mm. And it produced mental agitation. It produced sin, right? It produced sin because my mind was agitated. Why am I cutting up this poor, whatever it was, a frog or any kind of insect or animal? I just didn't go right with me. Somebody's dead body, cutting it up, and I had to be a physician. It produced mental agitation for me to do that. Throughout, my mind was on teaching or learning the scriptures or learning to do this. And as soon as I got that opportunity, I just glommed onto it. And this gives me what I'm doing now, great peace. So my personality, I would say, was more suited to this than any of the other things that I did. I gave some other examples of what I did in the past. And although it was very remunerative and very rewarding financially, it produced tension, stress, and mental agitation for me. Whereas what I'm doing now gives me great mental peace, gives me great satisfaction, and incurs no sin. I don't get that mental agitation. So as I meditate, I feel very peaceful. As I talk, as I think, I feel very peaceful. And that's basically what this verse is saying. But it says a lot of other things also. So let's go back. You may not be the best in your field. Like, I don't think I'm the best in the field, far from it, but I'm doing what I like to do. How many people listen, whether they listen or not, I'm just doing this hoping that some benefit comes of it. Whereas if I was doing a business, I wanted to make sure that I got rewarded, the profit was there, etc. So why is it better? Because whatever you do, that is your swadharma, has no conflict within yourself. You're doing your assigned duty. So there's no conflict, no agitation of the mind, no impurities that come into your mind. Whereas with your paradharma, that is the opposite of swadharma. Paradharma is somebody else's duty. That paradharma produces, goes against the grain. If you know what that means, if you have a dog or a cat or an animal, if you're stroking it along the grain, the hair is going down, it feels very nice. You rub it against the grain, even the dog or the cat will complain. Here you do paradharma, you may be accomplishing a lot, getting a lot of money, power, fame, etc., but it's going against the grain and you become mentally agitated, you incur sin, you're frustrated, you're acquiring more vasanas by doing this. This was already told to us on chapter 3 by Krishna in verse 35. So again and again, he repeats it, that you've got to do whatever is your swadharma, not your paradharma. So when you go against your nature or your disposition, you are not true to yourself. Therefore, you have conflicts and it retards your spiritual growth, very interestingly. Instead of saying, okay, well, you actually retard your spiritual growth. You're going backwards. So somebody that I talked to, I said, so why did I, if I had this ingrained in me, this was my personality, this was somebody that I respected. I said, so why do you think it was that I spent the earlier years of my life pursuing that instead of doing this? And he had a good point. He said, you know, it's quite possible that in your previous lives, when you had the opportunity to do this, you did not have the financial resources to be able to stop everything and be able to teach and to study and to do what you like. So you swore to yourself that first you were going to make, or your karmas determined that first you were going to make enough to be self-sufficient and self-sufficient for your family and to others in the world. And then using those means, you would be able to do this without asking for any help or resources from other people to be able to do that. I think that is. I don't know that, but it sits right with me, that explanation. So if you don't do that, it retards your spiritual growth. You may become wealthier by doing your paradharma. You might become more famous, more popular, but it retards your spiritual growth. This, when you do your swadharma, it helps your spiritual growth. And it's not necessarily only teaching the Gita or scriptures. Even if you're a basketball player and you're from an early age, you say, you know, I'm 7 feet tall and I want to play basketball. That's your swadharma. Yep. You do that, you'll feel very peaceful within. So everybody is assigned a certain duty in life. And when you do your swadharma, your sattvic qualities come to the forefront. Very interestingly, your sattvic qualities, your peace, your equanimity, your everything that is good for you comes to the forefront, and the others recede when you choose your actions according to your nature. So somebody I knew when they came from India were looking for a job in the United States, and they got a job in a convenience store. And he said, I'll take this job. It's paying me a small amount of money. I just have to stand at the counter, and I think I have to sell, you know, cigarettes, and people want to come in for various things, and I just have to sell it to them. It's something I can do. What he didn't realize, this was a strict vegetarian, never touched meat, never ate meat. What he didn't realize that in the deli at lunchtime, he had to cut lunch in meats.
Yeah.
So he had to hold a big slab of ham or whatever it was and slice it on the deli slicer. And it was grossing him out. It was against his nature. It was pradharma for him. It made him a lot of money, but he didn't like it. And he said, my hands then smell of this, even though I wear gloves, my hands smell of it, my body smells of it, I can't sleep at night, I'm very mentally agitated. He was incurring sin. And so only when he let go of that job and he quit, and he says, I don't care, I won't make money, I'll find another job. And he did. And he was much more peaceful at the next job. So when you choose your actions according to your nature, you're peaceful. When you choose something that is not according to your nature, you become agitated. Just, I'm giving too many examples. But one more. An intellectual, a Brahmin, if he's growing up and kids around him are teasing him that you're a weakling, he doesn't look at his strengths, which are that he's an intellectual, he's a Brahmin, and he may have been born to a warrior, he may have been born to a trader, a merchant, a Vaishya, but because he's a young kid and everybody around him is a Kshatriya family and very tough and big, and they tease him, he says, instead of saying, well, listen, I have my strengths, you have yours, you may be very good with brawn and fighting, and you're meant to go into some field like that, I'm meant to go into a Brahmanic field, he then says, I'll join the army, just to show you that I'm just as brave as you are. Now, if he joins the army with his Brahminical qualities, he's not going to make a good soldier, because as he's thinking, if he's got a gun in his hand or whatever he's got, he's actually thinking about what he's doing is not the right thing. Should I be in this war? The mental agitation is creating more conflict for him. So he's not a good Brahmin and he's not a good soldier. Mm-hmm. So he's not doing what is according to his grain. So I think you get the point. So there's no inner growth when you do something that is not according to your qualities, your nature, your disposition, and you're not even getting the benefit of doing whatever it is. So how does, and your mind doesn't mature. So what does that mean, mind mature? The Gita speaks to the entire world. People often think this is a religious sermon. It's not. It's not at all saying to anybody, you've got to convert, or you've got to do this, or you've got to pray to our God, your God. There's no such thing. It says there's one universal God. So the Gita, the Upanishads speak to the entire world, to all countries, to all races, to anybody from any religion of any age. And very importantly, although the Upanishads were written many thousands of years BCE, and the Gita was written 3,100 BCE, it's not just for that time. It's timeless. These values, these things that the Gita teaches us are for all time. And that's the beauty of this. Sorry, I'm so sorry. When it talked about sattvic foods and rajasic foods and tamasic foods, it didn't mention specific foods that they ate over there. It just gave us the quality of the food. It said, you know, what kind of food, whether there was oily food or whatever. And so that applies no matter what time of life you are in. And it also timeless, meaning it Gita speaks of the duty of your duty, my duty, as an at any stage of life. You know, it broke down life into various stages. In the beginning, you're a student, then you grow to be a householder, you get older and you start to become more spiritual, these kind of things. The Gita breaks it down according to your duties, according to your stage in life, and your duties according to your community, to your country, because you have duties to your country, you have duties to your community, you have duties to your family, to the stage in life. And the Gita basically teaches you that what your duties are. So whatever actions you do, whatever karma, has a certain result. We've talked about that. So here it's telling you, you've got to do your duty and you will get karma. Now, suppose you're a young person and you say, yeah, all of that is very well for you. But for me, I still want to pursue artha and kama. Artha means security. When you're young, you want to pursue security. You want to accumulate some money, some wealth, so you can take care of your family. And you're young, so you want to pursue the kama, the pleasure. So when you're young, the Gita says, go ahead, pursue that. But you're still attracted to the world and you're doing all of this. That's fine. You're not ready for moksha. Moksha is to be free of this world, to be free of having to come back and be reborn. You're not ready for moksha. But you preserve the right for moksha by doing whatever it is that you're pursuing for kama and artha. If you pursue it with dharma, with the proper right attitude, then Gita says you're still reserving your right to moksha, because when you get older, you can still follow it. You, while you're doing your duty, whatever it is that you're doing, he says, you have your raga and dvesha, likes and dislikes. If you do that with some good quality awareness of what your likes are and dislikes are, you will still preserve your rights to moksha. So the Atman self is within you, right? This Atman is blocked by ignorance. You don't know what you're looking for. You're just looking for kama and artha. You're looking for security. You're looking for pleasures, your pleasures of the flesh, pleasures of other kinds, of all your senses. So as you pursue it, you're blocking your Atman more and more. What you need to do is to take away those negativities, to take away those things that are blocking your Atman. An example that I heard that I loved is that when a sculptor looks at a block of granite, a black block of stone, he actually envisions wherever the block is. He says, this will be the face, this will be the body, this will be the shoulders, etc. And then he uses his chisel to chisel away the block so that his vision that's in the granite, in the block of stone, starts to come to life. Mm-hmm. And this, whoever made this up, this example, said that we have an Atman. You see a life, a vision of yourself, your Atman within yourself. So you remove your impurities, your negativities, your vasanas, your likes, your dislikes, until you get to the self. He says, another example is, if you have a cataract and you're blinded, you just remove the cataract and your blindness goes away. You can see. So you remove the cataract. Another example is monsoon clouds. When I was in India, every June would be monsoon time. And monsoon time, you didn't see the sun. There were dark clouds everywhere. And you knew the sun was there above it. But the clouds, just rain-bearing clouds, were all blocking it. And you beautiful rain would be coming down, great for the fields and the plantations. But you couldn't see the sun until the monsoon season was over. But the clouds had to be moved away, and then you could see the sun. So similarly, the Atman is blocked by all of this. We often think that if only I get to X in my life, I'll be very happy, right? We've all thought that. If I can get this, if I can get my child married, if my child could get a nice job, I'll be very happy. If I could get a good job, promotion, more money, X many rupees, dollars, I'll be very happy. And it's always never there. You always have another cloud blocking you from the sun. So much so that we know we are going to die, but we never believe it, right? We see others older than us, our compatriots, our people our age dying. And the concept of us dying is hard to come to grips with. You all say, oh, I'm going to die, but you don't really believe it. And there's a whole theory in the Gita and the Upanishads about those kind of things. You don't believe it. Similarly, you don't really believe that you have an Atman inside you that's blocked by negativities and vasanas and raga, dvesha. When you come to that realization, only then, like the sculptor, you say, okay, I see it. I've got to get rid of all of this. So the scriptures say, give up your ignorance. You have ignorance that is blocking you from your Atman. And what you're doing right now, learning, trying to absorb this, is your way of giving up ignorance. Now, the term giving up is also very important. Giving up, you give up something that you value. Right? If you don't value it, it's not really giving up. I mean, when you take your trash or your garbage out from your kitchen, are you giving up your garbage? No, it has no value to you. So how are you giving up your garbage? So when you give up ignorance, you say give up ignorance, it's like saying give up my garbage. You're not giving up ignorance. Ignorance has no value to you. So you should just get rid of your ignorance and supplement it with the knowledge that you're looking to get. You wouldn't be listening to this. You wouldn't be looking at this video or podcast if you didn't want to get knowledge. So you're on the right track. Now, our body, mind, and intellect matures, right? We know that about our body because when you were young, you were a boy or a girl. As you got older, you became a teenager, you became a man, you became a woman, your body matured. We all know that. Look, you know, you turn gray, your hair falls out. your mind also matures. And that's what I'm getting to. Your intellect matures. You know that, right? When you're younger, somebody right. gives you a mathematical formula, you don't understand it. Leave alone, do it. But as you get older, your intellect becomes stronger. You can realize things. You can do mathematical calculations because your intellect is stronger. Similarly, the mind matures. It matures. It has emotions. It has desires. It has two kinds of growth. The mind has two kinds of growth. One is knowledge. The mind, the knowledge is accumulated by both the mind as well as the intellect, the buddhi, mana and buddhi. But in addition, the mind knows, as it matures, how to interpret different stimuli that it faces in life. Different stimuli. It has an experience of a certain kind. It says, ah, now I learned that I shouldn't have done this, I should have done that. How to respond to stimuli and how not to respond to stimuli is something that you learn, your mind learns as it matures. So that's one. That's the second kind of mental maturity. The mind has to be dealt with. You have to teach it. You have to focus on the situations that you face and learn. So what happened? The guy said this to me, and what did I say back to him? And should I have said it this way? Maybe if I had said it a different way, he wouldn't have turned around and punched me in the face. Maybe I should know better for the next time how to deal with this situation. And the situations, my friends, have been sort of similar throughout history of mankind. They're no different today than they were when our ancestors were cavemen. So when your computer doesn't work today and you get frustrated and you want to smash the computer on the floor, maybe somebody does, versus when you were a caveman and your pick or your knife or your tool breaks in your hand and you're frustrated because you wanted to carve this piece of meat and the knife that you were using, stone knife, broke. You get frustrated. or when you're a man, married man, and your spouse is a married woman, your spouse is looking at somebody else, you get jealous, upset.
Yeah.
I'm sure that the caveman or the cavewoman had similar experiences or feelings back then. So these mental emotions of the mind, these are all, we're talking about the mind. Mind is filled with desires and emotions. That's what its main and only function is. So this, it was the same, the Gita says, from beginning of mankind to now. Emotions haven't changed. Your responses to emotions are based on what you learn and mature your mind to do. So the mind grows in two ways. Cognitive, which you learn through Gita as you're learning now, the cognitive learning. And the second is therapeutic. You learn through life's experiences. You learn how to deal with people. You learn how to deal with situations. So the cognitive, the learning through the Gita, you know, we can do. The learning about experiences, you have to force yourself. You know, people just sometimes just flow with it, like the tamasic people. Just do it again and again. They don't learn from their experiences.
Right.
The smart people learn from other people's experiences. The not so smart people don't even learn from their own experiences. It takes you years to learn something. Medical school, you can go for years and years of medical school and then internship and residency. It takes a long time. So similarly in life, it takes you a long time to get to the point where you understand that you are Brahman. Aham Brahmasmi, Tat Tvamasi. When you get to that point, to get from that point, to get rid of your raga dvesha and to get to be one with the self is, they say, easy. It's hard to get to that point. It's hard to get through medical school, internship, residency, fellowship, etc. But once you get there, the rest is easy, because then the rest is going to take care of your patients, and you learn very quickly from that. So he says the same thing happens. Getting to through all of this is the hard part, this knowledge. For you to convince yourself that you are the Atman, you are the Brahman. But once you get there, from there to getting to be self-realized is a simpler step. So you have to follow this spiritual path. You have to become self-centered. Now, people may say, well, self-centered, you know, that's not a good thing. No, it is true. To be self-centered is good. You do want to be self-centered, because the self they're talking about here is the capital S. The capital S, the self, the Atman, the Brahman within you. To be centered on that, to be self-centered, you follow a spiritual path. To do charity for others. You know, it's easy to do, to say I want to do charity work, but it's very, very important to understand what is going on with this, because you don't want to be doing it for your small little self. You want to be doing it for your big self. You want to be doing it anonymously. You want to be doing it for other people, for their benefit, not for your own benefit. Who are you? Who am I? Who is he to help others? Everything he is, I am, you are, is because of other people. Think about that. Mm-hmm. Whatever you are today, you are because of others. Whoever took care of you, whoever taught you your ABCs, whoever taught you mathematics, whoever put you in school, taught you to clean yourself, have a bath, how to conduct yourself in life, all of those teachings over your last 20 years, 30 years, 50 years, 60 years is what created you today. So you have a lot to be grateful to other people for, right? You weren't born with these qualities. Everybody wants to be the one to give to other people. You, me, everybody wants to be the one to be on the giving side. Nobody wants to be the one to be the one necessary to receive. Nobody likes to receive charity. People don't say, I want to be a person that's taking charity from you. So if you are in a position to give to somebody, you're very fortunate. You're very lucky. So take that with a great gratitude. Take that with gratitude that you are in a position where you can give to others. Don't be so haughty or feel that you're superior by giving it. If you find a recipient who's needy of your charity, be grateful to that recipient. You are blessed. the donor is more blessed than the person receiving the charity. Keep that in mind. So you may say, well, I'm being selfless. Nothing is selfless. Nothing. You may think everything that you're doing is selfless. Nothing is. You may say, well, I can't be happy when someone else is suffering, right? People say that. I give it because it hurts me to see him on the pavement like that begging and he's starving. So it hurts me. That's why I'm charitable to him. Well, if you're doing it because it hurts you,
right,
and it makes you happy to give it to him, then you're helping yourself to get rid of your own hurt, to get rid of your own. So you have to keep in mind that doing charity is something that you want to do for the benefit of the other, not for how it makes you feel. Not to say, I can't be happy and when I see somebody else suffering, but when I take care of his suffering, then I am happy. So nothing is selfless is what I'm saying. And if you say selfless, which self? Which self are you selfless of? Which self? The family self? The employee self? The national self that looks after the nation? Or your religious self? Mm-hmm. For your own happiness, for your growth, for your peace of mind, for your own shanti, you do these things. And accept it. Accept it and be grateful for it. Don't think that you're being very magnanimous. You're very blessed to be able to be in a position to be charitable in that sense. So what we want to do is to get free of our likes and dislikes, free of raga and dvesha. Nobody is free of raga and dvesha, right? You heard what I said, but yep. And you took it with a grain of salt, but nobody is free of raga dvesha. Just like nobody is selfless. I'm saying something that may be controversial, but you see that in the Indian mythology, Krishna, who gives all this entire sermon of the Gita, is shown loving to play the flute. Did you know that, Lou?
No, I didn't know that. No.
Yeah, if Krishna, when the Hindu mythology went to Greece, Krishna was called in Greece the god Koros, K-O-U-R-O-U-S, Koros. And Radha, his consort, was known as Rhodos. Did you know that?
No.
Koros and Rhodos. And the Greek mythology has pictures of Koros, Krishna, surrounded by cows or sheep. And he's holding in his arms a sheep or cow. A calf, and Radha is next to him. And in the Greek, I wish I had ways of showing pictures here on these videos, but Kuros or Krishna is shown playing a flute. Everybody knows what a flute is, right?
Yep.
Yeah, playing a flute. So he loved playing the flute. And by the way, Rhodos, the term Radha, Rhodos, is also where we get Rhode Island from. The island of Rhodes, all of this is because at that time, before Christ, before Christianity, before Islam, before Judaism, everything was, before Buddhism, was Hinduism. And Hinduism was basically Krishna and Radha. And so all over the world were things of Krishna, names of Krishna, Kuros, or Radha, or Rhodos, or Rhodes. But I'm digressing.
Mm-hmm. You're getting ahead of yourself. That's the
That's right. That's the next series of podcasts.
Yeah.
So Krishna loved to play the flute. So you may say, wait a second. I thought you said that to get to be self-realized like Jesus was or Krishna was or Buddha was, you had to get rid of your raga dvesha. Now you're telling us that Krishna loved to play the flute or Jesus liked to be in the company of Miriam, or Buddha liked to eat certain things, which we know. But you said the self-realized person did not have any likes or dislikes. They do have likes or dislikes. Krishna liked the flute. He liked to play the flute. It gave him a lot of peace and inner peace. The difference is whether that raga and dvesha that a self-realized person has is binding or non-binding. Now, what does that mean? What does a binding raga and dvesha mean? So if you have a like, if Krishna liked the flute, and for some reason he couldn't find his flute, he couldn't find a flute, his flute broke, and he had said, I have to make myself a new flute or have to buy another flute. In that meantime, would he get dejected? Would he get depressed? Would he get anxious? Would he feel sad? No.
Was he attached to it? Was he in bondage to it?
Was he in bondage to it? Right. Yeah. If it was binding because the lack of the flute made him unhappy, then he was bound to it. That kind of raga and dvesha is not what you want. If he was able to just shrug his shoulders and say, listen, I can hum, I can sing, I can whistle, and I may not be as good as having the flute, but at least he's not dejected. Then it's not a binding raga and dvesha. So that is the key, that it should not make you angry, frustrated, depressed. You can find some other way. No jumping up in joy when you have something that you like, and no feeling dejected when you don't have it. It's the attitude in life that you and I should have when you cannot have what you want, cannot have what you like, and you have to have what you dislike or what you don't want. You don't have these ups and downs. Your life becomes much more smooth as you go through life. So don't bury yourself in your past failures. We always say, oh, you know, in the past, don't bury yourself in that. That's not good. Sorry, my tripod moved.
That attachment to the past hurts so many people.
Yes, attachment to the past. The shastras, the scriptures, only refer to raga dvesha by meaning that they're talking about binding raga dvesha, not non-binding raga dvesha. Okay, so when we say you've got to get rid of your raga dvesha, they're meaning the binding raga dvesha. Just thought that I would make sure that we all knew that. So to summarize, it's been what, about 35, 40 minutes, Lou?
Yeah, 37. Yep.
Oh, good, good. So to summarize, this verse says doing one's own duty is better, even if you don't do it as well or it's not as rewarding. It's better than to do the duty of another. Even if you're not able to do your own duty well, and you can do somebody else's duty very well, Krishna says, do your own duty. You will be peaceful versus agitated. Even if your own duty is not as rewarding or not as much respected by society as the duty that you would do of somebody else. So what do you think, Lou?
Again, funny, we go back to the very basic start of this, which is about fearing attachment and fearing bondage to your sensory needs and your desires and things like that. And here we are nearly the end. We wrap around to it. But I love this reoccurring theme that we've had here at the end, where same message, but we're so much better. We're so much more open to it. We have so much more knowledge and we can apply it so much better, right?
Yeah. You know, Lou, I was just thumbing through and looking through some of our earliest episodes. It was just 2 years ago that we started?
Probably.
And there's been such a difference in just my ability to speak, to explain. I've grown, I've matured, my mind is matured, and also yours, Lou. Okay. Yeah. If you get a chance and you go back to some of our earliest episodes and listen to them. So friends, we all evolve. Lou and I have matured as these episodes have gone on over the 2 years. We've gotten older, gotten wiser, and I'm hoping that as you get this knowledge, you will see how you evolve also. Right, Lou?
I think it's important for me. I came from nothing in this, and so I've come through the first circuit here and learned so much. But even as we go back through the summary, I'm learning more, and I think you were just stating that you've even learned through this experience, having gone through this more times. You stick with it, you keep going around, your knowledge becomes greater, it becomes deeper, it becomes a bigger part of you, I think.
Yeah, and you know, one thing I've learned is that while I was a student myself, I still am a student, you know, there's a certain kind of learning. And when Krishna says you're supposed to do this, one way of doing your karma is to take this to the next level and to share with others.
Yeah.
As I do that, as I explain, as I talk, I think that I realize how much it helps me personally. I wasn't doing it so that it would produce that result. But when you do a good karma, it always helps you in some way or the other.
And isn't it interesting? I mean, you're probably seeing it with your grandkids now. I remember as an early parent learning that just going through everything with your kids again just makes you so much wiser and gives you so much knowledge. It's often that second or third trip around that just seats that wisdom in you.
So true. So true. I see it with my grandchildren. Good example. Yep. Thank you. All right, friends, we'll see you next time. Thank you so much for being here.